Welcome to Talk of the Bay. I'm Christine Barrington, and we are going behind the mic with Jill Cody, host of Be Bold America. KSQD is community radio, and whether it's music or talk, much of the programming streaming your way on 90.7 FM is created by community volunteers, offering their expertise for the sheer love of doing what they do. But who are the people running the studio, spinning the tunes, and sharing tales with local and national personalities? Well, their stories will likely surprise and delight you. My guest tonight, Jill Cody, wants you to experience the thrill of becoming an empowered citizen. Every other Sunday on her show, Be Bold America, she hosts local and national thought leaders who offer knowledge, insight, and strategic choices for recreating democracy based on people like you and me seizing the reins of their own political freedom. She is a public servant in the truest sense of the word and had a career as an urban administrator and academic, which put her in a position to understand this dire political moment and inspired her to write two books, America Abandoned, The Secret Velvet Coup That Cost Us Our Democracy, and Climate Abandoned, We Are on the Endangered Species List. Two works that can help us understand, how did we get here? And equally, how do we move forward? So now let's pull back the curtain to discover what ignites Jill Cody's tireless dedication to uplifting our capacity to be bold, informed, and engage in caring civic action.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us behind the mic.
Christine, thank you for the opportunity.
It's such a pleasure to get to know the programmers here at K-Squid. Each individual that I interview has such an incredible story. The personality that they offer on air is like that tip of the iceberg, and I'm wanting to get under the water and get into the body of who each of you are.
Well, so thank you.
So, Jill, you had a career in academia with an advanced degree in public administration from San Jose State University's Political Science Department, and you taught there for many years. You seem to live and act as a political scientist. How did you get bitten with this passion for civics?
Well, it just evolved. Before I was at San Jose State University, I worked for several cities, the city of Milpitas, the town of Los Gatos, the city of San Jose. I was working full-time with the public for 8 years before Ronald Reagan said, the 9 most terrifying words I've ever heard are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And I went, I am there to help. And I had, you know, a great relationship with the public before those words. You know, we would have public hearings, we would solve problems, there would be issues in the city, and we'd pull people together, and we all felt like we were on the same team. And then after those words were said, I really quickly saw a change and division between the people that worked for the government, known as public servants, were there to serve, and the people that we served. It was just became more antagonistic. And it got to the point where towards the middle of my career, you get yelled at with, I pay your salary. You have to do what I want you to do. One of the things that I worked on was a assisted housing development in the town of Los Gatos. Not public housing, but assisted. And it turned into something so ugly that I got death threats. The city council got death threats. The town manager got death threats. Propaganda, misinformation was being spread all over. And so I got to see at that point the ugliness in communities, the us, them. You know, we earned our way here. They can't get here without earning their way. And I thought, well, they have to pay a third of their income to be in this housing development. They are working. This isn't what you're afraid of, because the undercurrent always was the them could be people of African-American or Latino, always that undercurrent of hate. So those 9 words that Reagan said really made a big shift in government, in my view.
It's incredibly mythic, almost. I see this image of sort of a Greek story where the god of disorder comes and just drops a seed in the middle of a community and everybody starts losing their minds. And it seems like that to me.
Yes.
Yes. And from that point on, it really felt like kind of a madness really took hold. I don't know if it was channeled through the lens of his charisma or what.
Well, know? I think it is that. And to a certain degree, the people behind him and Ronald Reagan wanted to do away with unions, because where did democracy actually flourish was within unionized organizations. So private company unions, public unions. When Reagan started, I think 33% of this country was covered by unions, which had a larger impact. When that 33% were able to negotiate holidays and overtime and wage increases, that applied economically pressure to other companies. And so more were affected than the 33%. Now I think it's less than 7% are in unions. So and a lot of changes have happened. And there's been just this chipping away at democratic institutions since Reagan, and a lot of tax cuts for the wealthy. Mm-hmm. And we started seeing that income inequality start back then. And also what started back then, and something I observed early on, was Paul Weyrich saying, we don't want everybody to vote. Our power goes up, meaning the Republican Party. Our power goes up when the votes go down. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said. So back then, the message was they're going to suppress votes. They don't want everybody to vote. They don't think everybody deserves to vote. Again, the undertone being those of minorities. And with Reagan dividing the government, what is the number one principle? Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. What a psychological mind trip. And it's kind of like a stake in the heart of what we like to think of as like good government and democracy. And it's a betrayal. So you have written two books, America Abandoned and Climate Abandoned. And so this theme of abandonment, right? When we're abandoned, there's a betrayal undercurrent in there, whether it's explicit or implicit. And this theme of abandonment, it's very personal for you. Would you be willing to share with our listeners why this word abandonment resonates so strongly for you?
Yes, there are actually two things that have happened in my life, but one, I'll start with my mother. My mother was abandoned by the people that were meant to protect her. And I'd like to read the definition of abandonment, because mm-hmm. I think it's an important foundation for people to realize mm-hmm. that abandonment consists of withdrawing our support or help from someone or something that especially needs and deserves our duty, allegiance, and responsibility. So that could be at the family level, the community level, the society level. And right now, I feel it is at our democratic level, because we have one political party and a two-party system that has abandoned America. I mean, it's very clear now as they support Russia that
they've abandoned. It's clear in
so many ways.
So many ways, yeah.
But for me, my mother was actually a very beautiful woman. Her mother and father were divorced early on. These are the early 20s. Back then, her mother didn't have many work opportunities. You couldn't sign for a loan. You couldn't get a job. You weren't considered valuable to educate. I mean, it was basically you needed a man and a husband to make it. Well, what happened when my mother's mother, my grandmother, who I never met, was divorced, she would then became a mistress to another man who took care of her and my mother. And that happened for many years so that they could live and survive. Because again, and I think this is an important point about why we have safety nets in our society now. There's no safety net back then. There was no health insurance or money to help raise a child. Or I hate to use the word welfare, because again, the Republicans have demonized that word.
Right.
But if you look at it as keeping well, you know, being fair to individuals who are citizens of this country.
Yeah. Support.
And don't have the opportunities to be able to survive. Then and you know that the children need to be supported and loved. So my mother was a mistress for many years. Then that gentleman passed away and she had nobody. And what do you do with a teenage daughter? You have no income. There's no safety nets. There's no community or governmental support. I know churches are supposed to fill that in, but they don't always. And in a small rural community that this was. And so she turned to prostitution. There wasn't much left for her to be able to survive. So she turned to prostitution.
This is your grandmother.
My grandmother. And so, again, there's a country that just, because there wasn't anything in place at the time, a country that just abandons people that fall to the bottom because there weren't those safety nets. The men that take care of them divorce or pass away. And so she's turned to prostitution. And my mother, being a very beautiful woman, ended up being raped by my mother's pimp. So she is raped as a teenager, learns to trust no one, is abandoned by the people that are meant to protect her, meaning her mother. She's doing her best she can, but it's not enough to stop the scarring, the wound. And then her grandmother was a physical abuser to my mother. So the people that were meant to protect her, the duty, the responsibility, weren't there. And it damaged her. It damaged her so much that when I was being raised, there wasn't any hugging. There wasn't any I love yous, that sort of thing. So I could go into more about my childhood of feeling abandoned. But that I think is one of the root issues for me, is looking back on my mother's life and realizing there was nobody there.
Nobody and no thing. There's these layers of abandonment, familial, but then there's this system that has betrayed the sort of deeper spiritual contract. You know, this planet is rich and abundant. There's more than enough for all of us. But these falsely created classes and hierarchies, which you talk about in your book, create all kinds of miseries. And we'll get to that later, because what you just shared is huge. You share some of your story in your book. You talk about abandonment, but you didn't share some of these deeper details that you shared just now. And I remember when reading your book that somehow there was this flavor in your story that felt deeply feminine. And now that you share those deeper details, this is a story, a feminine story. For many women, even being married feels like a form of prostitution. But it's a survival game. You know, it's kind of terrifying but courageous to be like, I'm got to live and raise my daughter. I'm going to put my body on the line. That's huge.
Well, and then mental illness ensued too.
Of course.
Because the abandonment of her.
Right.
The original divorce, the person dying, being left alone. And the religious community didn't help in this area, because my mother and the grandmother weren't baptized anything. Back then, you had to be part of that religious tribe to get any help.
Once again, you're not deserving just for being a human being.
Exactly.
You've got to
fit. You're not one of us.
You're not one of us, or you're not doing what I want you to do.
And again, it's the early 20s for my mother, and through the 20s and early 30s. So, you know, I think back on that. It was pretty awful.
Right.
And even when I was 13, my father decided that he didn't want to be married anymore and walked out on us. Abandonment again. And I remember my mom getting a letter from State Farm Insurance that said they're not going to insure her car anymore. And what was the reason? Because you never know who's going to drive a separated woman's car.
Wow. Fascinating. Historical record there.
Yeah,
wow.
But obviously my father got insurance on his car, and I don't know how it came out that they knew they were separated, not even divorced, but separated. And she couldn't get car insurance, so my father had to come in and co-sign on that. And then my parents decided not to get divorced at that time, waiting for me to be a little older. But I remember when I was about 15, 16, my father preparing me for the divorce, because back then the law hadn't passed of no-fault divorce. So I had to testify on the stand against my father, because there no-fault laws weren't passed. So my father was preparing me by saying, you know, I'm going to be the bad guy. This is what you need to say on the stand, because your mother and I want a divorce. And I think it was more my father wanted the divorce. And so there I was, you know, a 15, 16-year-old teenager in court on the stand having to testify against my father so that they could get divorced. I was so delighted when the no-fault divorce laws were passed because of the pain and process that that put me through as a teenager.
Tolling for the deaf and blind, tolling for the mute, while a mistreated, mateless mother.
You are listening to KSQD. I'm Christine Barrington, and we are behind the mic with Jill Cody, host of Sunday's Be Bold America and author of two books, America Abandoned and Climate Abandoned. We'll be back with more right after this short break.
Times of freedom flashing.
A lot of this history about your mom, you didn't even know.
I didn't know until she passed away. And my stepfather told me and brought me up to date. And he was wonderful to her, loved her and gave her what she needed. But by that time, she was even agoraphobic. I met my husband 24 years ago now. And back then, she wouldn't let him in the house for a year. She didn't know him. She didn't like people very well. And my stepfather, his persistence and his love for her, I think they were together at least maybe 12 years before she finally said yes, because she felt he would leave her.
Right. And now we know so much about the human nervous system and neural nets that get set in place and all these chemicals that keep running. Mm-hmm. And we just keep operating from a state that is a memory of the past. And yet this wonderful gift of love came in and was somewhat of a healing balm. And so you then went on to become really a public servant and a truth teller. And I'm really curious, in the midst of all this challenge, when did the civic bug bite you? What inspired you?
I wonder if it happened at birth. Mainly because...
Did you come out waving a flag?
Yeah, maybe. Because I actually took, in college and then later when I worked for the city of San Jose, the Myers-Briggs personality test, which is very detailed, actually. You know, three generations. It started with Carl Jung, I think, and then a mother and a daughter. Mm-hmm. I forget which one was Briggs and which one was Myers. But so it's three generations of work. And I was the same in college as I was when I took it again when I worked for the city of San Jose. And my personality type is idealist teacher. So that's why I say maybe it happened at birth, because that's who I was in college, and that's who I was when I was working, and that's who I am today. And I look back at what drew me, the things that drew me that I wanted to educate myself on. I went to an organizational development academy that the city put on. Well, what is that but making the world better, continuous improvement, looking at organizations, looking at systems, looking at people. How do you bring them together? How do you improve a system, as I said, or organization or society at the level that I've written my books? And then the climate abandon is at the world level.
Your work is just so psychological. That's what really struck me. Now, my training is in psychology. You mentioned Jung, and he's one of the great inspirations of my life. But I want to focus on this question of how deeply psychological your work is. I feel that psychology is so important. It's more important to be taught in high school than calculus, than chemistry, because people that understand psychology can either inspire and lift us up, or they can manipulate the hell out of us. One of the things you talk about in America Abandoned is you bring in this principle of the 1%. I have never heard anyone else bring it in related to politics. That's been swimming in my head. The 1% of the population are born psychopaths.
Yes.
And 1% of the population are born pedophiles. There's some very interesting 1%. There's this Far Side cartoon, and it's God with the earth, and he's got this shaker, and it says jerks on it. And he's like, let's keep this interesting. And it's like, we're on this planet where people are just born psychopath. Many of those people seem to rise to the top echelons of power. So you bring this up in your book. How about you speak to why you felt that that was a very important thing to bring in very early in your book, America Abandoned?
And I did even say, I think it was in my first chapter, that it might feel strange that I'm talking about psychopaths at the beginning of the book. However, psychopaths seem to find each other, and they also are drawn to the limelight. Yeah. So there are more of them in politics. Mm-hmm. And there are more of them in our financial institutions.
Yeah.
They're drawn into power positions.
Narcissistic and, supply.
They yes, they're drawn into power positions. And where are those most visible is politics and finances. So I think there was an Australian study that actually said that they felt that 14% of the people in power in the financial institutions were psychopaths. So they rise to the top because, you know, if you've got to lay off people, who's the best person to do that?
Right.
To lay off 10,000 people
yeah.
is somebody that really doesn't
have
the empathy to care.
Mm-hmm.
So they do rise up to the higher levels because of that quality mm-hmm. is seen as a plus in many corporations. And I want to say at this point, too, if corporations were a person, they'd be psychopaths because corporations and they're looked at as people, which is a whole nother issue. It's a SCOTUS issue. It was just a side note written by a conservative staff person to a conservative Supreme Court justice that's been taken to the law and has infiltrated our economics, where Mitt Romney can say, corporations are people, my friend, and you've got to laugh. Because people made that as a construct,
yeah.
a construct so that we could come together to do business. But now that it is taken as religion in corporations and on the right, as a religion that corporations are people, then they are psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
Because corporations cannot have compassion, empathy, or humility.
They don't seem to.
No, they
you know,
don't.
It's not their job. It's not their mandate.
No,
right?
It's not their mandate.
Is to make money. It's a different game, and it should have rules appropriate to the game. The United States, I believe you can correct me, you might know this better than I do, but my understanding was early on in the United States, which wasn't a pretty picture for the indigenous people and stuff. There was already a lot of disturbing
yes.
things going on. However, there were a lot of good things going on. And to get a corporate charter at the beginning of the United States, you had to have a statement that there would be a return. There would be some kind of a public good in order for you to have the right to do business in this fabulous place.
Mm-hmm.
And all that seems to be gone. The people I know who work in business and they're brilliant and they're talented. And there's this mantra of, you know, we're just giving the people what they want. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so.
No. Well, a lot of those laws have been chipped away at. A lot went down during Ronald Reagan's administration, where the responsibility isn't there anymore. Those values aren't there.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the Donatella Meadows Project. She talks about systems change very eloquently, really powerfully, and she describes these acupuncture points that you can apply pressure in a system and change the system thereby. And interestingly, she says the most powerful acupuncture point in a system is mindset. As Jung said, every individual in every society has an organizing story. At the time, he called it a myth, but it's really an organizing story. And as long as that story is alive for you, the whole society organizes around it. You quote Sidney Blumenthal in your book, who is, he's a writer, he's a journalist, and he also was in Clinton's administration, I believe. And he wrote that the conservative counterculture is very energized, extremely organized, and highly strategic. And they believe in what they're doing, such that they're organized really strongly. I think for the tender-hearted people of the world who are appropriately human and have doubts and have some maybe humility and maybe have some confusions, it's harder to organize us into X, Y, and Z. And so we don't organize as focused. That was a long speech.
Well, what came up for me when you were talking is that I'm a Star Trekker. You know, and they talk about the space as the final frontier.
Yeah.
And I really think going inward is our final frontier.
Yes.
People are so afraid to self-reflect because once you self-reflect, you might not like what you see and you might need to change.
Now, that
1% can't self-reflect, the psychopaths.
And they don't need to because they're doing everything.
Right. They're perfect. But the 99 of us, if we are, and this is getting back to what we need to be taught early on, is to be able to look within and to be able to make changes in our personality or have the ability to apologize.
Yes.
You know, there's a whole meme out there that apology is weakness.
Yeah.
And so you never say, I'm sorry. You never apologize. And that's all the way up into now our politics. So I think the final frontier is when we talk about psychology, is knowing who we are. what we stand for.
Our value system.
Our value systems, mm-hmm. leading principle-centered lives. Mm-hmm. And one of my mentors was Dr. Stephen Covey. I knew him, but I also was licensed to teach a lot of his work. He was a Republican. Back when Clinton was president, Bill Clinton asked him to come to a meeting at Camp David, and that message came to him while he was in a party with fellow Republicans. And they said, why are you going to do that? Why are you going to go? He's a Democrat. You know, they gave him a little bit of heck mm-hmm. for it. And he said, excuse me, but he is my president first.
Thank you.
He's my right. president first. And he asked me to come to this meeting. And so I'm going to go. So there was already that division. It was after Ronald Reagan. So that division of Democrat and Republican was started back then. But what he talked about in a lot of his work was living principle-centered lives.
Yeah.
Well, how do you live a principle-centered life if you don't know what your principles are? And again, I'm talking about positive principles, mm-hmm. you know, positive values, constructive principles, constructive values. There was another mentor of mine, Dr. Wilfred Jarvis, who is an Australian, and a social behaviorist. He did a amazing work, Four Quadrant Leadership, it was called, and he also divided our emotional energies.
Right.
He said, we are beings of energy. Mm-hmm. And he divided our emotional energies, taking the complications of our human emotions and distilling them down to what he called living in the red, living in the black.
Right.
And he used a principle of your checkbook. When your checkbook is in the black, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, you've got extra cash there. You're living within your means. When your checkbook's in the red, you're not living within your means. You're owing people. It's negative. It's destructive. Living in the black is constructive. So taking those down, those human emotions, into those two areas and thinking, where do you predominantly live? So I do have, and I want to share, some of those emotions. And I brought his Living in the Red, Living in the Black.
I'm so glad you did. I was just going to bring him in, and you were right there. This is where we are in sync.
We are in sync.
Yes.
So I just brought his handout so it would remind me. So again, living in the black is being creative and constructive. When somebody is primarily, predominantly in their lives living in the black, then they are secure and feel safe, they're trust and are trustworthy, they can show love and approval, they accept others, value the difference is one of the Stephen Covey things, value the difference.
Beautiful, yes.
Celebrate the differences.
Yes.
And that means culturally, individually, heritage-wise, value immigration, value Black people, value the Hispanic and Muslims,
yeah.
because they all bring
it reflects nature. Nature,
yes.
nature celebrates diversity,
yes. Celebrates
and it
diversity.
Keeps us safe, right?
And yeah. I also yeah. look at diversity, just to digress for a second, as a diamond.
Hmm.
We have different facets of a diamond. There's a facet that actually can oppose, that creates that beautiful brilliance. But the whole thing is priceless.
Hmm.
That diamond is priceless.
It's a beautiful metaphor and an image, yes.
So that's what I think about is diversity, is value, and celebrate that. So getting back to Dr. Wilfred Jarvis, when you're creative and constructive, and you have meaning and hope, and you live with your loyalty to your values and to your principles, and you transcend yourself. You let go of your ego, not totally, because we need some of our ego.
Sure.
We need our ego. But you can let it go in certain situations. And people that live primarily in the black, you are impelled to move towards them. You want to know them
mm-hmm.
because they're putting that constructive and creative and compelling energy out into the world.
Right.
So the opposite of that then is living in the red. And what Dr. Jarvis said was that is a destructive and disruptive emotion. So there are things like insecurity and anxiety, fear, anger, hatred, disapproval, rejection, reaction, humiliation, inferiority, futility, despair, apathy, cynicism. I mean, I just start feeling down just reading those words.
Yeah.
You know, you just sort of. So both worlds are kind of out there. Some make a lot of money on Fox so-called news makes a lot of money keeping people in fear and anger and anxiety and building hatred because it goes for that lizard brain.
Goes right into that limbic system.
That
and
limbic
amygdala
system.
And
boy, they can make lots of money with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel so sad because they're constantly being agitated with the fear and the anger and the us and the them and the futility of it all.
And it's such a shame because we could be living such incredible lives together and still, you know, disagreeing and having differences of opinions.
Yes,
but
being
it could
two
be
facets
glorious.
Of that diamond.
Yes, it could be glorious. And what a waste. And I find many people find it very difficult to comprehend the power of this discord that has erupted on our world. And you wrote America Abandoned in 2016 or published it.
Published it
so,
in 2016.
So you clearly worked on it before. It's so spot on and chillingly accurate that there's been a velvet coup. The people who have executed this velvet coup, you've said this already in this interview, but you're going to get to say it again. They don't care about democratic principles. They don't want everyone to vote. They want what they want. And we've been taken over, and it's the frog in the pot. We have some aspects of democracy still in our grasp, but the whole ship is nearly lost. What inspired you to write this book? What happened? And tell us a bit about your process, because I'm telling you, people, this is a brilliant, brilliant book. If you're wondering, like, what the heck happened, read America Abandoned.
Well, thank you for those wonderful words about the book. And it, again, was an evolution, again, through my career, seeing our democracy slip away. Again, it started with Reagan's 9 most terrifying words, as I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And all of us were in the government and there to help. But the division started then.
The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. That's what election day is all about. The biggest gun we've got is called the ballot box. So if you don't like who's in there, vote them out.
This is KSQD. I'm Christine Barrington with Talk of the Bay, and we are behind the mic with Jill Cody, host of Sunday's Be Bold America. Jill is a passionate advocate for the power and responsibility of personal civic action. She is the author of America Abandoned, The Secret Velvet Coup That Cost Us Our Democracy, and we'll have more right after this short break. Welcome back to Talk of the Bay. We are behind the mic with Jill Cody of Be Bold America. In this segment, Jill dives into the troublesome dynamics of the capitalization of the public good. You might remember those heady days when it seemed privatization was the royal road to an efficient government. Well, Jill offers her bird's eye view from a front row seat in the city government of San Jose. Let's have a listen.
I also saw during my career the movement to privatize everything, to privatize government, to privatize the government's actions, because certainly money can be made there. How I view a society is a three-legged stool. We have the government, we have private corporations, and then we have nonprofits and religious organizations. There's that three-legged stool, and if one of those legs goes, we're going to fall. What I saw through my career working in the public sector was the chipping away of the government side of it, the democratic side of it, so that, you know, and the corporation side wanting to get more and more powerful. So I back many years ago, he's passed away now, I saw the Commonwealth Club speech by Pete Peterson, and he was a multi-billionaire who hated Social Security, and he was determined to destroy Social Security. Yet, at that Commonwealth Club, he talked about being such a victim. He was such a victim because people were mad at him for wanting to do that. So that just was, you know, one lesson in my brain, that a multi-billionaire that owned the most beautiful a sailing ship called the Maltese Falcon could feel like a victim because people were upset that he wanted to destroy Social Security. So that's something that I saw and witnessed. And then the privatization of everything. And when I was with the city of San Jose, that was a huge issue. They would assign different departments and say, what part of your department could be privatized? And made the public employees, say, streets and traffic, that are also responsible for the street trees. What can you do to privatize street trees? And you have to compete for that job now. The people that were public employees needed to respond to requests for proposals and sit there and be interviewed next to a company. And it's the same thing with our ambulance service and on and on. And I went, wait a minute, let's look at the root here. The difference is people in private government want to make a profit. The people in the public sector don't need to make a profit. So why do we think it's better to privatize public services?
Because there's a story, there's a mindset. Oh, the golden child, the capitalist, they're always going to be the most clever, and competition will ensure the survival of the fittest and the best execution and blah, blah, blah. Some truth in there, but the deeper value system will always corrode because it's how can I extract?
There's a seed of truth. Yeah. And yes, having to make a profit on everything. And the city of San Jose really got stuck with that because they privatized the ambulance service. What increases the profit? You don't maintain your vehicles as well. So there were all sorts of problems when they entered into a contract that privatized the ambulance service. I'm not saying everything should be in the public sector. I don't want my jeans made by the public sector. Mm-hmm. I don't want my automobile made by the public. I mean, these are private sector roles. There yeah. are definitely roles. And the government develops a lot of, like the GPS system was developed with NASA. And then that was sold off and given to the private industry. And then they were able to take it and make a profit and develop things. But I don't want my water privatized. I don't want my sewage system privatized. There's some things, you know, the fire department. Our energy privatized. There are some things where what we talk about is the commons.
Yeah.
In a democracy, we have what's called the commons, that we have to come together to support each other. I cannot have my own water system. That has to be developed by the community. You can't have your own fire department. We have to come together. But because the people that want to privatize see the ability to come in there and strip it away and make money, that happened seriously back when George W. Bush was in office with Social Security. Let's privatize that. Let's put it in the Wall Street. Let's make money for people on Wall Street. There's so much money in the Social Security Trust Fund, because it's our money, it's an insurance program of our money put in trust in the federal government. It's not an entitlement. It is not the government's money. It is
right.
our money, like
an
insurance. We paid into it. But there's so much money there that it makes those 14% in the finance industry drool
yes.
that they want to get their hands into it. Well, think what happened in 2008 when everything crashed. If we had done that, our homelessness would be even worse than it is today, and today it's a disaster. So there were a variety of evolution of things that I saw. And then again, I was already interested in political science, so I got a degree in that, to see, again, how you improve government, how you make things better, that idealist side of me. And I think the one aha moment was when my mother passed away. And I learned how she was abandoned. And then I looked back over my career, how there was a force to abandon our government and divide people, to abandon the public sector roles in our commons for privatization, to force others to abandon their vote. That idea that our vote doesn't count. Your vote doesn't count. It's one vote. Well, why should I go vote? But that's a message out there that those that want to steal our democracy want you to believe.
Yeah, these past couple of elections shows what just a few votes can
yes.
do, right?
Yes, how important your vote is.
Yeah, we're like hanging on by a thread, and that's why they're putting
that's
so much
right.
energy.
That's exactly
yeah.
right. So there are all these messages out there. So when my mother passed away, and I saw abandonment through her life and how it affected my life, and then I looked back on my career, that word came forth for me. And then I've realized we've abandoned this country to guns. We can go nowhere. We can't go to concerts. We can't go to markets. We can't go to town hall meetings. We can't go to clubs. We can't go to school. Mm-hmm. We can't be first graders. We can't be teenagers. And yet nothing has been done. We have abandoned this country to guns, and we don't have the freedom and liberty to walk around and shop or go to concerts in Las Vegas. We never know when it's going to hit.
I had asked you the question, what inspired you to write this book? And one of the things that comes through very, very clearly in the book that was published in 2016, you, I'm sure, took a number of years to write it.
I started in 2013.
And you were speaking very powerfully to the reality of oligarchy. And it was sort of coming into my consciousness at that time, but it's so clear now. It's just staggering. And I would like to think that we've got to come together. Somewhere in your book, you have a great quote that says, you know, we've got to come together to save ourselves. And I believe that. I'm like, okay, the power of the people. I have to believe that people are ultimately more powerful than money. That's my hope. And you quote a study by Martin Gielens and Benjamin Page mm-hmm. that was completed in partnership between Princeton and Northwestern universities that demonstrates when you have an oligarchy, which they say we do, given the situation we have right now, the power of individuals and even massed organizations of individuals is statistically insignificant, which sort of puts a dagger in the heart of this belief, like if we just organize, we can make a difference. And I remember when that study came out, and I have felt really confused because I believe that we saw in the 2018 midterms, in the 2020 election, in these past midterms, the power of people coming together to make a difference. So I'd like you to speak to this paradox, please.
Yes. Gielens and Page, powerful study. They looked at the effect that citizens have towards the legislation and the decisions are being made in our Congress. And it basically, they said it was net zero impact. Now, the dichotomy is what's the alternative? Because we can't give up.
I agree.
You know, we can't give up. Mm-hmm. And again, this is part of my heartache for democracy, is that I'm not sure democracy is going to win in this effort. I'm really not sure.
Right.
Because Citizens United and previous Supreme Court decisions handed the power over to the oligarchs, corporatocracies. They own the corporations, the big, powerful ones. And they've got a lot of money. And the Supreme Court handed over to them the power that whoever has the most money has the most word, most power with our congresspeople, people that make decisions. However, having said that, we have seen individuals make a difference and make changes. One woman started the Black Lives Matter movement. It was so powerful that, again, the right wing is threatened by it and demonizes it. And so we're now seeing the backlash to that, especially in Florida, where they came up with, you know, critical race theory that was never taught. I mean, Young, who's the governor of West Virginia, ran on getting critical race theory out of the schools, K through 12, on something that never was in the schools. You know, it was never there. It was a law school concept. So we're seeing this backlash to the Black Lives Matter. But that was one person mm-hmm. that's made that difference. And we do have individuals that are really, those single individuals that are really fighting to save our country from the torment of guns. They're out there. The hope side of me says, you can't predict the future, and there's always something will happen. And that person wasn't a politician. That was one woman who cared that started that whole movement. So it could be you, it could be me, it can be anyone that can come up and make that difference. In the climate crisis, nobody knew for many, many years about Greta Thunberg. But that one child has created a huge difference.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
In In case you have just tuned in, you are listening to Talk of the Bay on KSQD. We are behind the mic with Jill Cody, host of KSQD's Sunday program, Be Bold America. She is the author of Climate Abandoned, We Are on the Endangered Species List. And we'll be right back with more from Jill about what we can do to nurture democracy and be the change right after this short break.
Yes, hallelujah. I'm gonna let it shine.
Welcome back to Talk of the Bay. We are behind the mic with Jill Cody of Be Bold America. In this last segment, Jill brings home the discussion to a foundational truth. The United States was born from sacrifice and courage, and she suggests democracy can only endure standing upon these same roots. As Benjamin Franklin said when a woman approached him after the Constitutional Convention asking, "What kind of government have you given us?" He replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Let's drop back in.
There also have been tremendous, horrid laws in trying to take our protesting ability away. We're in a very push-me-pull-you time right now. Mm-hmm. So the hopeful side of me thinks, we can do this, we can do this. We've got to organize and we've got to keep at it, because what's the alternative of giving up? And they literally, that one party that has abandoned democracy, they'll take over.
I have great faith in the creative spark and the spiritual spark in each individual, that when we become coherent within ourselves and we join with other beings that are coherent and clear, I know that good things can come of it. I cannot operate any other way, and to just give up and give in just seems to go against something very, very fundamental in our deepest beings.
Well, you just raised this, I think it's very important, about when we come together, what we can do. Mm. So let's talk about our founding fathers.
I'd love to.
Who came together.
Yes.
And look what they did.
Yes.
And what they gave up, because most of them we know about is Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, maybe John Adams and Thomas Paine. But there were 56 of them that came together, and the average age was 33. You know, we had Benjamin Franklin there on the upper end, but the average age of them was 33.
That's extraordinary.
So these were young men, that realized that they did not want to live under the thumb of a monarch anymore. One person, they didn't want to live under that thumb. So they came together, signed a Declaration of Independence. They knew the minute that they signed that Declaration of Independence, they became traitors, because the operating government at that time was the British government. So they knew that they would become traitors. But there were 56 of them. And to remember some of their stories that aren't as famous, people don't realize what some of these men gave up for us to have this country, so that we wouldn't be under the thumb of a king.
And a class system.
And a class system, or a dictator, that we come together and they gave us something that hadn't happened in the world before. So I want to just share a couple of stories of those that gave up everything. One of the wealthiest, Thomas Nelson from Virginia, died in debt at age 50 because he had mortgaged his home to pay for the Revolution. But the British seized his home and lands and damaged it so severely that he was unable to repay his mortgage. So he was ruined.
Wow.
He signed that Declaration of Independence. So that's Thomas Nelson. There was a Philadelphia merchant, Robert Morris. He lost 150 ships at sea during the war that led to his ruin. He signed the Declaration of Independence. He knew what he was doing.
And he gave his all. Yes.
And he gave his all. He lost 150 ships. There was John Hart of New York, who died alone and miserable 3 years later. His wife died soon before he signed the Declaration of Independence, and his 13 children found themselves scattered among sympathetic families to hide them from the British and conservative loyalists. John Hart never saw any of his children again. So I think we need to think more about what our founding fathers gave. And the movement that's happening today, the anti-democratic movement, just don't give a hoot.
They don't. You know, I think about it often when I think about George Washington's Continental Army. They were freezing, they were starving, and many of our fellow Americans were feeding the British and selling to the British. And I often think about about the forces I'm seeing today, and like, I wonder where you all would have been.
Yep, they were the conservative loyalists.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, and they were fighting against the group that wanted to create a whole new system where we weren't under the thumb of a dictator or an authoritarian right. or a king. Because basically, those are the other forms of government. You know, one man rule somewhere. So we see that in Russia. We see that in China. We see how Hungary lost their democracy. We're seeing it in Turkey. You know, we're seeing this one man rule get stronger and stronger during our times. And yet the human heart wants that freedom and liberty. And what gets me is the people that yell freedom and liberty are the ones that want the one man, strong man rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I think eyes wide open after that happens,
mm-hmm.
but then it's lost.
Yeah, I think we're going to go through an extraordinary period of change. And again, my hope is that more and more of the people that are sympathetic, truly sympathetic to democratic values, will awaken out of their civic learned helplessness. I'd like to just take a moment to discuss this since psychology is my field. And what we see with young, developing human beings and even animals, that when they're constantly confronted with negative input where they cannot see a solution, they develop learned helplessness. They fail to realize the power that they have. And I feel that our system right now, especially like consuming the media, it's so terrible. It's so terrible. It's so terrible.
To make you powerless.
There's deep, deep civic learned helplessness such that most of the people do nothing but vote. And if that's all you do, it's not enough. Our media is so depressing. We don't hear enough of these stories of what will work, and we're not painting the clear enough picture of the full arc of what will work. We have to be energized, we have to be strategic, and we have to work cohesively. Everything that the extremist right has been doing, we need to do. And my hope is that more people will listen to you, listen to the stories you bring forward, listen to all the resources you offer.
We have to take our power back.
We got to take our power back.
That's why I wrote this book.
Yes.
It's to show people, because each chapter ends with a keep, stop, start.
Each chapter ends with resources.
What you can do, because voting isn't enough.
It's not.
And when you take your power back, then you realize action is the antidote to apathy. And that is how we win. When we fight, we win. So people have given up their power. And I just want people to take their power back.
And celebrate it and enjoy it. Revel in it, because actually, when we engage, things happen. So on that note, I want to close by simply asking you a couple questions about your show. When does your show happen? Where can they find you?
My show is called Be Bold America, and I close my last chapter of my book on I'm waiting for boldness in this country. And I relate how bold we were in the past, and somehow we've lost that boldness that Americans can do anything. And we can. Yes. We live in the black.
Yes.
We can do anything.
There's so much as possible.
And so much as possible. Mm-hmm. And we've proven it in our 245 years. We can get there again. So Be Bold America. It's on Sunday evenings, every other Sunday at 5 o'clock. And the three things that we cover is how to restore and fight for our democracy, the kinds of things that affect our democracy, and the kind of discussions that we're not having about it. Same thing with the climate crisis. We talk about different things when it comes to climate, and we talk about principle-centered leadership and living our values and being constructive, creative, compelling people, not destructive, disruptive, repelling people.
Beautiful. And if people miss your show on Sunday, they can always catch it on podcast platforms, correct?
Yes, it is made into a podcast, and it's put out to 10 platforms. So it can be found on Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public. It's on our station's website.
And it's on KSQD.org.
Personal website, yes. JillCodyAuthor.com. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, so it's out there in the world. And last year's wrap-up on my podcast, I found this very interesting, that the country that's on the top of my listeners was Lithuania.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? But also France and Germany and Iran and Brazil. So it is listened around the world. again, podcasting is a democratization.
It is.
Of the spoken word.
So you're not only, you know, this is community radio, and you are part of building our local, our national, and our global community. So listeners, Jill Cody has two books that you can read, America Abandoned and Climate Abandoned, and her fantastic show, Be Bold America, every other Sunday at 5 p.m. Jill, wow, thank you so much.
Wow, thank you, Christine.
Thank you for joining us behind the mic on KSQD Santa Cruz. I'm Christine Barrington with Talk of the Bay, and you can find more behind the mic interviews as well as a recording of this program at ksqd.org. Just do a search for Behind the Mic to discover more about the marvelous volunteer programmers who make KSQD your community radio station for the Central Coast. They've all come to look for